I have a very feeling of being informal, mostly because, at least to begin with, I'm really asking as much as anything else. So, but it felt to me what I've been thinking about yesterday and today is how do we learn? How is it that we learn? How does that happen? And how do we know? And what knowing means? So kind of big questions, but kind of worth thinking about in this kind of silent, collective, and individual experiment. And I was thinking about how it's kind of known, even I think measured, that when we try to make a change, sort of learn and try to internalize and make a change based on a more external understanding that something will be good for me and effort and willpower, it's quite known that it fizzes out within about 6 weeks at the most. It taps out, like some decision, you know, to eat differently or whatever it might be, when it comes from skin deep, it doesn't last. And then maybe everybody here has an experience of something that comes from, that has changed and comes from a different place. So even very small. So what kind of knowing do we know, or what kind of knowing have we come across even in the last few days? And does it feel rare, or does it feel universal, or very, very individual, or how is it, provisional, sort of good for now? Maybe I know it, but not necessarily. Tomorrow might be, this might not be relevant anymore, even for me. And can we feel where the wanting to know comes from in us? Like, can we feel the stem in maybe the desire for stability or safety, or the other thing, or maybe both, sort of in wanting to so that I can have wings, I would like to know something. And so as you listen, just inviting, and it could be someone could share if you feel like it, just a little nugget, like a little drop of something that feels like we know or we learned. So it could be, I'll just share one or two like that. I think I can say that maybe it's not so recent, but a knowing that when things get uncomfortable in the experience, then between 5 to 15 minutes is good, and will bring a change, whatever, even if nothing in the circumstances have changed. Just something that maybe from allowing enough time of being with uncomfort. Of course, there's worse and there's better, but I'm just in these few days, so feeling it, and 5 to 15 minutes, something, just a little knowing thing. Or I think it's at 8:30, after feeling a little bit cool for those hours of the yoga and the meditation, and just coming out and feeling the sun, and just knowing kind of that's good. that feel, that I know that that feels good. So if anyone feels like sharing any kind of knowing moments, no pressure.
I recognizing starting to get stuck in a thought pattern that I don't want to be in involved in. Sometimes I just move somewhere else, stop walking, just move my body a bit. That helps.
Cool.
Just let go of that a bit, change the scenery.
Change the scenery, cool.
Yeah.
That's so nice because it also sounds so much like there is that expression. So it's sort of universal knowledge, but it's totally becomes only mine when it becomes mine, and maybe it's not true for somebody else.
I know that when I have a pain, even if I know from where it comes, until I cannot go down this knowledge and to the heart, the pain won't disappear.
Yeah. And then, do you know what might help between now and then?
Actually, just I'm grateful to my body that it's so intelligent and reminds me that no, this still this is not digest yet.
Yeah. So it sounds like there's familiarity and trust.
Yeah.
So somewhere.
Yeah, and it's something that I cannot trick. Shit, still there.
That's so good. That's so good. Yeah, I so much wanted to talk about that. That honesty, and also, I guess while there could be, or there is, sort of this big pool of the drops, the nuggets of what we know together here, spoken or unspoken, there could also be, maybe it's bigger, but like some other body of water that's everything we don't know. Who knows? Yeah. So we don't even know the size of it. But there's these little, and even when they're even when we don't know how long will this serve me, this knowing, there's a knowing. I find it very, very interesting to be on this path. And the moving out and coming back in, like waves between the bodies of knowledge and tradition and wisdom that exist, and my own learning, internalizing what resonates, becomes a truth, change of scenery, or trust that I'm here and it needs to go up to there. And then there's a part also that would very much like to have things figured out, to have a little bit of clear through some of the not knowing, get a little bit more of the knowing. And and a lot of wisdom out there. So there's really famous guys like Gautam Buddha, and I think a lot of not famous ones also, who discovered a lot for themselves. And maybe in our days, there's a lot of copyrights and trademarks going together with the knowing. Knowing something and then, you know. Kabir says, the yogi comes along in his famous orange, but if inside he is colorless, then what? So then what? So even just if we would say, oh, just change the scenery, but that's actually never worked for us. But here's a hollowness. So I've So there's wisdom and there's traditions and there's maybe also the interest in seeing what we're attracted to in teachings and teachers, what's inspiring, like sweetness or charisma or humor, you know, what maybe there's a flavor that's more particular to each of us. I've been studying an approach, kind of psychological, but not really coming from that, called focusing, which many have heard some. So I want to talk a little bit about Eugene Gendlin, who he says discovered this method. I think he's 91, and originally from Vienna, one of those from the Jewish families that, with the rise of Nazism, left in 39 and went to New York. He was a child, and he was a professor of philosophy, and not of psychology. He didn't ever have formal studies, but he had very close friends in that field. And so one interesting thing is the way the experimentation, the learning that he went through to come to uncover this technique or method or whatever we want to call it. And what he and a group of students did, because one person couldn't do it, it was huge amounts of work. They had recorded therapy sessions, like maybe a few thousand hours of recorded therapy sessions, and they had at least by subjective, which is pretty good, they had the knowledge of which therapies were successful. In other words, which people said about them, their lives, that there was definite improvement and were satisfied with change, and which felt just as despairing, like that really didn't get me anywhere all those many hours. And then they divided up the recordings into the patient or the client and the therapist, and they listened separately, not to the conversation, but separately to the ongoing talking of the therapist and to the ongoing talking of the client, and came together as a group, as a research group, to the conclusion that really the therapist made no difference. Like, better or worse, the scale, still that wasn't a factor. And then they started listening in to what the clients were saying, and they basically discovered a certain kind of way of speaking, which was less, which had gaps and had questioning. So it would be sort of, that kind of thing, rather than a sort of, well, this and that and that and that. There were gaps and questioning and kind of pauses waiting for maybe the understanding or the right image or the right description of the person's situation to come out. And that correlated with the successful therapies. So that was kind of a turning point in his discovery. And I heard him, I watched a couple of videos of him, already much older, and I think he's talking to therapists in a way, and you always get the sense that he's really a little bit frustrated with therapists, particularly psychologists, for being so reluctant to let go of their theory and everything they ought to know. But he doesn't discount it completely. But he talks about this place of meeting, this place of himself, if he's the focuser, meeting the person who comes. And he's aware of having his body of knowledge of past experience, theoretical knowledge, and he's aware of having his impression of the other person, and he's aware of having his impression of how he is, and he is capable of feeling that space can be made, these can be put aside for another kind of, to support another kind of listening that both are doing. And I find it very inspiring what comes out of that. It's interesting that Jenlin felt in his discovery in the 70s, which was also part of the environment of the 70s in America, and not only in America, that this discovery would revolutionize the field of therapy and would deprofessionalize it, that this would be something that ideally people could just do for one another. Anyone could intelligently and compassionately listen to and be listened to in this way. And so he didn't go that route of copyright and so that if you study it now, anywhere you study, and you can study in many places and get your certification, but percentages are not going to him. He didn't go that way. He didn't think that was necessary. And from what I've heard, in his old age, like the last 15 years of his life, he and his wife have been in poor health, and America being as it is with its approach to health and supporting people. So it's been hard for him. And students who knew him, first generation students, up to this day, do kind of dana for him, do conferences that in order to give. So that's another nice way of feeling his in it with us also. So today I had a couple of conversations about yoga, and I'd kind of like to bring up yoga as a good example, which is in what we're doing, and also its own thing, but as a practice that has its roots so far back that it's not from the time that it came, nobody's opening their mouths to tell us about it. So, like many of what we're doing, has its roots so far back. And then it's been kept alive, and it's also, there's a kind of urgency now in the world to reawaken the wisdom of the various practices, and also specifically with yoga. So to make it relevant, and making it relevant changes it and it diversifies. And so there's many different ways, another way of saying, of learning yoga. And So as with many practices, we can take something on and take it quite seriously and go with it and experience understanding and experience progress and experience fun, experience pleasure and experience accomplishment and well-being and change. And then very often what can happen is that something becomes a problem. Something doesn't work, and it's usually something in our body, which could be an injury, or it could be just something that as we go from the undifferentiated, from the everything sort of, what is this blob? Okay, it's arms, it's legs, it's this, it has parts actually, and I can slowly start to feel them out. And then there's this one part that's really not working. And I think it's very common for us to feel that, well, there's a lot of different options actually, but we could widen our initial idea of this practice and start to explore ways in which it can accommodate the thing that isn't working so well. And then our learning is expanded and we benefit. The range expands and we benefit. Many times it can feel that the method is really super good and so is the teacher, and the disaster is just my hip or this something in me. So that's the part that can also be not just in physical terms and not just with yoga. So practices that really seem to serve us and take us, and we accumulate our bits of knowing and experience, but the sorrow or impulsiveness or hip or whatever, certain unworkable that we would like to what to do with them. Today, washing the dishes, I saw one of the kittens. You probably noticed the kittens coming down from the tree just by the sink. And I didn't see, the first one went down, I just saw the leap, but the second one I could really see he was quite high up and terrified. And just taking the few steps, like really digging the nails into the tree for fear of falling because he was quite high up. And then you could just see him stop at about this height and just see if it was okay and then just leap. That was okay. That one he could do by a leap. The other ones were like with rope climbing, like really getting the thing in there. And the hair is standing on end. Really, you could see that. So, and I just felt such a resonance, like sometimes it's that way. Because we're also so motivated. We don't want to stay on the tree just, or never get up on a tree. We don't want that. But it can be really terrifying. So it's these steps or that one. And then I saw the mother walking by, and there was just that grace, that sort of unproblematic, I belong on this earth kind of walking. And he'll get there, or she'll get there. It was nice to feel both, to feel the way that we even embody both, and that amazing pull toward understanding, toward knowing, toward healing, toward growing, that is maybe as inevitable, sort of in our DNA, as the cat's story of just growing bigger. So I don't know how much I do want to talk about this, but just that sense of that the thing in us, the disastrous thing, the hip or the shoulder, whatever it is, the anger or the whatever it is, being one of the maybe harder to decipher nuggets in the thing, in the little collection, in our collection of valuable, maybe provisional, maybe only temporary, but valuable things that we're collecting. And Jaya mentioned, I think also in this course, in this retreat, but also in the first, a couple of times, so I don't remember exactly, but Jacques Lucérien, the French man who became blind through an accident, childhood accident, and the way in which that loss of the physical seeing in the conditions of love and support and confidence that Jaya spoke about could create such a tremendous capacity for seeing on so many levels of also, I think, taking, like you were talking about, that bat seeing, that sort of actual able ability to discern objects, like how close and how big is that tree from me. But also, his description is so cool of being really a youth, like really young, and just circumstances of the occupation in France making it so that they just did it, you know, the resistance, and he was in the role of the final person that you come to, that they sent to discern the honesty, that this would not be a person who would be talking to the Nazis. So after going through a few other what would that be called, like in the sifting process, finally the person would be brought to him and he could just feel, is this someone we can trust? To then, in the infirmary, the worst place to end up in the concentration camp, just being this amazing source of light, of comfort, at like the last stop place. So I guess it's important to remember his support and his confidence as being part of that, so that we can remember that when we're when we've become so short-sighted, myopic, when everything narrows to just my disastrous hip, we're not really an alert, we're not really in a workable situation. We can't really take it anywhere. We can't walk on the hip. It won't go anywhere, or the whatever it is. So there's that need for ventilation and wideness, and in that, discovering what we love, what is okay, what is a solace, what exactly bird sound is to us the funniest and coolest, or feel of the sunshine. Krishnamurti says, when the mind is really silent in the face of a problem, really silent, the problem can become as beautiful as a sunset in that really silent space. So what would nurture that kind of silence is one question. And yeah, I read it in, there's a poem of Rilke in translation. Maybe only a part of the poem, but he's talking about a time where the old, the unhelpful ways are starting to come undone. Sort of the currency is like there were tyrants who abused the resources of the people, and it's starting to change that old order. And he talks about the ore, which was taken out of the land to make coins. The ore is homesick. It is eager to leave the coins and turning wheels that offer it a life so meager. From coffers and from factories that are making it into those coins, it would flow back into the veins of gaping mountains whence it came, that close upon it once again. So this, I guess, connecting from these kind of little nuggets of knowledge or wisdom that we can collect, and a sense of maybe recovering a bigger source. Maybe even sometimes we can feel that not only is my hip not a disaster, my hip is a genius. My hip is a genius because it's taking me all that way. But not alone, not if I'm just, you know, hip. Not on its own, but opening out to support and what we love and the wider view. And what we can definitely know about our life, collecting those. And the honesty and the ability to not know a lot of things. Not to push ourselves to land where we would say change of scenery and not actually feel it inside, because those are the coins at the moment being used, where, so if I want to exchange with people, I'll use those, even if it doesn't buy me anything. It's no longer buying me anything, so we could just let it drop and slowly make its way back somewhere. And just to end this little exploration, I want to read a poem called Kindness, also by Naomi Shihab Nair. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. feel the future dissolve in a moment like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go, so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. Desolate, like empty and lonely. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore, only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, it is I you have been looking for, and then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend. Thank you for listening. May our practice be dedicated to the momentum of awakening and growing and learning and opening and supported by kindness. For all beings, including ourselves.